Howdy. Somebody knows I'm having a downtime.
I'd like to bring the House Committee on Consumer Protection to order, January 26, 2009. Keep saying that to keep me reminding myself we're in a new year. Today, committee and members, we are going to be having an informational meeting on mortgage lending and foreclosure issues, overview of what we dealt with in the 2007-2008 sessions, which led to the mortgage lending work group, which has been ongoing for since that time. I don't know that they're currently meeting anymore, but and then after that we will have a public hearing on House Bill 2188. So with that, we'll go ahead and get the informational meeting started, and I'd like to bring up the Department of Consumer Business Services, Corey Streisinger and David Tapman. And committee, this task force that they will be referring to was a governor's work group on mortgage lending after the 2007 session and 2008. We had a lot of issues around mortgage lending, and a work group was formed, of which a few of us participated, and many folks in the audience here participated in as well. So we'll be hearing from several people on this work group and the issues that were dealt with and the recommendations that were made. So with that, we'll let Ms. Streisinger take it.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. For the record, I am Corey Streisinger, Director of the Department of Consumer and Business Services. With me is David Tapman, who's the administrator of our Division of Finance and Corporate Securities that includes mortgage regulation. And I'm going to be leading off with the testimony, and then both of us will be happy to answer questions. And you do have a package of materials in front of you, which I will also be referring to as we go through. We appreciate the opportunity to be here today to talk about mortgage lending, a topic which has been of great interest to the legislature and to this committee over the past couple of sessions, and of course has been making the headlines in a way that many of us would not have predicted a few years ago. So what we would like to do today is to provide you with some background on mortgage lending in Oregon, give you some information about what we're seeing today, particularly with respect to foreclosure rates, describe some of the actions that have been taken thus far to address these issues at both the state and the federal level, and then discuss our proposals for future action as well. And I should start by saying that residential mortgage lending can take many different forms. A homeowner can take out a first mortgage to buy a house. And they could also do a refinance, either to obtain better terms or to draw equity out of the house for other purposes. A homeowner may also take out a second mortgage. Sometimes that's referred to as a home equity loan, and this could be in a single lump sum, or it could be a home equity line of credit, which then they could draw on for other financial needs. Mortgages are also available through a variety of financial institutions, and we touched on this very briefly last week during our department overview testimony. Entities that do mortgage lending include federally chartered banks and credit unions, state chartered banks and credit unions, consumer finance companies, and state-licensed mortgage bankers and mortgage brokers. And as I think we mentioned before, federally chartered banks and credit unions are largely outside our reach as state regulators. About one-third of residential mortgage loans in Oregon are made by federal banks and credit unions. The other two-thirds are made by entities regulated by the state, and by far the largest number are made by state-licensed mortgage bankers and mortgage brokers. And it is worth mentioning that we don't have one single set of statutes that covers mortgage loans generally. Instead, the way our statutes have grown up, there's a separate regulatory scheme that applies to each type of lender, which certainly complicates things. Historically, until roughly 20, 25 years ago, most residential mortgage lending was through banks, credit unions, and savings and loans that usually kept the loans in their own portfolios. But as the secondary market developed, a savings and loan industry disappeared, banks in Oregon shifted their focus to commercial lending. We started seeing a new type of lender take over a good chunk of the market, and that is the non-depository mortgage brokers and mortgage bankers who make real estate loans, which are generally resold. And then recently, in particular, with the boom in the real estate market, we've seen a number of new and non-traditional types of mortgage loans becoming widespread. When I first bought my home a long time ago, you got a 30-year fixed mortgage, and if you were really, really adventurous, you might get a 30-year mortgage with an adjustable rate. But now we see a whole range of types of adjustable rate mortgages, often with low introductory teaser rates that are scheduled to reset after a couple of years. We also see some of these loans with payment options, which offer a flexible choice of terms, including the option of paying interest only or even paying less than the interest due, meaning that the loan will have negative amortization and you will, after that initial period, owe more on your mortgage than when you first started out. And one feature of these loans with the initial rates that then reset is that once the initial period is over, your payment rate will be much higher. Many of these loans generated high fees and were designed to be resold into the secondary market, where they were bundled into securities, sometimes known as collateralized mortgage obligations or CMOs, and then they were resold again. And as the nation has now learned, these non-traditional loan products, particularly those in the subprime lending market, pose significant risks as housing markets slowed down and housing values leveled off. Many loans had been made without consideration of whether the homeowner would be able to afford the payments once the interest rates or payment levels reset. And as we have now learned, a number of major lenders had essentially abandoned any analysis of their borrowers' income and assets, offering loans known as stated income loans or no documentation loans or the like. And unfortunately, we all now know the end of this story. Many homeowners with these non-traditional mortgages began to experience sharp increases in their payments as the real estate market cooled off and then headed downward in many parts of the country. Foreclosures began to rise, particularly in the subprime market. The financial markets became unwilling to purchase the collateralized mortgage obligations made up of subprime mortgages, and the subprime lending market dried up. So subprime borrowers who had expected to refinance their loans once that initial period was over became unable to do so, resulting in more foreclosures, and we've now seen a downward spiral in housing prices. But one of the results is that even those with more traditional mortgages are beginning to find themselves underwater, that is, owing more on their mortgage than the current value of their home, which means that if they need to sell or refinance their home, it's impossible for them to do so. Falling home prices have also led many lenders to pull back on home equity lines of credit, which many homeowners had been using to finance a variety of their personal needs. So, where are we now? Although we are still doing better than many parts of the country, foreclosure rates have risen significantly in Oregon, and we believe this is likely to continue as mortgage rates continue to reset. A number of these adjustable rate mortgages in Oregon were issued between 2005 and 2007. So through 2009, since many of them had an initial period of 2 years, we are not through for all those loans that initial period. According to the most recent statistic, and I should say one of the first attachment, which you'll find in your packet, attachment A is a fact sheet on foreclosures, and so you can see more of the detailed numbers in that fact sheet. According to the most recent statistics from the Mortgage Bankers Association, 1.31% of Oregon mortgages were in foreclosure in the third quarter of 2008, which is about 8,400 households, and that's a 16% increase over the second quarter of 2008. It's about 130% increase over the third quarter of 2007. The rate is significantly worse for borrowers with subprime loans. According to the MBA, about 7.26% of subprime loans in Oregon were in foreclosure in third quarter 2008. For adjustable subprime loans, the rate was 10.84%. little over 1 out of 10. Delinquency rates, that is, borrowers who have missed one or more payments, are often an indicator of future foreclosures, and of Oregon borrowers with subprime loans, the MBA reports over 14% had missed one or more payments in the third quarter of 2008. And it's over 16% for those with subprime adjustable rate mortgages. Again, these are significant increases over last year. And if you do some of the math based on the numbers, which you'll find at the bottom of our sheet, which gives you a sort of advanced look, you will see that we do have another, we estimate 13,000 subprime adjustable rate mortgages, which are expected to reset through the remainder of 2009. Since refinancing is not available for many of these borrowers, a borrower's best option may be to seek a loan modification through the lender, and a number of lenders are offering loan modification programs now, since this is a problem, of course, that extends across the country. There have been several attempts to facilitate and increase these loan modification programs at the federal level, but unfortunately they have not yet proved very successful. The federal programs are, we understand, cumbersome and expensive. In working through their options, we believe that one of the best resources, probably the best resource for homeowners facing foreclosure, are the counselors certified by the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development, or HUD. And these counselors can review borrowers' debts and obligations, try to identify options, try to develop a workout plan that will look at all of the borrower's financial situation, not just the mortgage. And, in fact, these counselors can also work directly with the lender, as well as providing advice to the borrower. And at the state level, our focus has been on increasing the availability of foreclosure counselors and matching them up with the borrowers who are in need. We worked with the Housing and Community Services Department to obtain grant funding to train and fund additional counselors through local nonprofits. We have also worked with Oregon Legal Services to obtain grant funding for 3 years for legal assistance to those needing foreclosure help. We have put together a foreclosure referral service through an entity called SafeNet, which gives homeowners assistance and matches them up with foreclosure counselors. They have a toll-free number as well, and we've also provided a number of resources through our own website. You will see in your packet our foreclosure brochure, which you may have seen already before. We provided you with copies in English and in Spanish, and actually one of the other attachments, which is at the end of this set, because we put it in at the last minute, it's labeled Attachment L, is a list of HUD's counseling services across the state in the event that you have constituents who want to know where they can contact a counselor in your area. These resources are available, and we're happy to help match people up as well. One of the concerns is that even when help is available, it won't do any good if the borrower doesn't know that it's available. And the stories that we hear are that over half of borrowers facing foreclosure, in fact, go all the way through the foreclosure process and lose their home without ever contacting their lender. And that may be even in the situation where the lender has a loan modification program available. That was one of the topics that the legislature took up in the February 2008 session through House Bill 3630. That bill requires that homeowners facing foreclosure be given a clear notice telling them what to expect, telling them how to contact their lender. The lender is required to provide a telephone number where an actual person can be reached, putting them in touch with counseling resources and telling them how to receive legal assistance. And we did provide a copy of that notice in your packet as well. I believe it's Attachment D. I hope it's plain language. Our intent was to give people the information that they needed at the time when they could make both best use of it. Legislature in February 2008 also addressed one of the other concerns we were seeing starting to increase at that time, and that is the prevalence of so-called mortgage rescue schemes targeting people at risk of foreclosure. These could be offers for consulting services that are never provided, or consultants who steer homeowners to choices that, in fact, are disadvantageous for them, or situations in which someone would actually end up taking equity in the borrower's home, resulting in the homeowner ultimately losing their home. And through House Bill 3630, the legislature placed restrictions on all of those activities. We are now hearing of what you might think of as the next wave, which is people holding themselves out as loan modification specialists, offering for a price to put people in touch with the loan modification programs, where the HUD foreclosure counselors have that information and can provide that service with greater expertise and for free. So we are looking at that emerging issue. We want to make sure that we have a handle on that activity, and we believe that one of the bills that we will be bringing forward will be sufficient to restrict that these loan modification specialists, and if not, we will bring you a proposal for how to do so. Hundreds of Oregonians have taken advantage of these counseling resources, but many more have not. And even for those who contact a HUD counselor and their lender, relief is not always available. Not all lenders have loan modification programs. And particularly due to the securitization of a lot of these mortgages, the actual entity on the other side of the loan may not be a single entity. The loans may have been bundled and sold off in pieces, and it may be extremely difficult to identify an actual person or business that has the ability to modify a loan. In addition, unfortunately, because of the nature of some of these loans, we are seeing some borrowers who are simply finding themselves in homes that are more expensive than they can afford. The problem does continue to receive significant attention at the federal level, and several approaches are being actively considered. One that's receiving a great deal of attention at the moment is a proposal to allow federal judges to order modifications of residential mortgages, so-called cram-downs, as part of federal bankruptcy procedures. And in particular, when the borrower owes more than the value of the home, the way a cram-down works is that the loan would be reduced to the value of the home, and the remaining debt would be placed in the category of unsecured debt. As of last week, we understand that this is not going to be included in the federal stimulus package, as had been discussed previously, but that members of Congress continue to be interested in moving forward with some version of this proposal through other vehicles. And we also understand that there may be foreclosure relief funding as part of the next round of the TARP funds. So we are paying very close attention to those developments and looking for opportunities here at the state level. And I understand, in addition, there are some other proposals being developed on the Senate side. So I expect that we will be back for further discussions with you about other options for dealing with the challenges being faced by those who see foreclosure coming their way. So I would like to turn next to the actual regulation of mortgage lending, if I could. And while many of the most troubling loans may no longer be available today, mortgage lending is still going on, and mortgage lending will be going on as long as Oregonians need to buy homes. These are critical financial transactions. So we all have a strong interest in making sure that the types of lending practices that we saw in the past don't recur in the future, and I want to talk about that a little. We began seeing increased complaints and concerns about mortgage lending in roughly 2006. There's a number of actions that we've taken internally since then. First, we implemented new rules tightening up supervision over loan originators. Those are the salespeople who work directly with the borrower. So supervisory staff are now required to review loan originators' files and correspondence, enforce compliance procedures. Loan originator education requirements were tightened up, and we have new entry-level testing. And another one of the bills which the legislature passed in the February 2008 session, Senate Bill 1064, also gave us the authority to ban loan originators from the industry if they violate the law or if their standards of conduct don't meet expectations. We have also put in place new rules addressing misleading or deceptive advertising. For example, the rules now prohibit the advertising of teaser rates or teaser interest levels unless the advertisement at least as prominently discloses other key terms, including the annual percentage rate. Prohibit advertising of stated income or no doc or similar loans without disclosing that they may have higher costs than other loans available. Advertising loans that aren't actually available or for which the borrowers are unlikely to qualify. Using the name of the borrower's current lender and sending a communication that looks like it might come from the borrower's current lender when it's really an advertisement for a refinance loan, unless it prominently discloses that the person sending the advertisement isn't affiliated with the current lender and that this is actually an advertisement for a new loan. Those advertisements are particularly troubling because they tend to result in borrowers who have perfectly satisfactory existing loans ending up in refinance situations that offer worse terms for them. And I will say that particular wave of letters, which many of you may have received, came to a fairly abrupt halt after we put these new rules in place, but we are starting to see those letters show up again. And if any of you are receiving them, please send them our way. We would like to see them from an enforcement standpoint. We have increased our mortgage examination staff, and as we mentioned it last week before this committee, we have a budget package to request additional examiner staff. Regular examination of mortgage lenders, where we review their business practices and their files, is a very important tool for identifying problems early. Our goal is to examine each new, will be, if we succeed in achieving the additional staff that we're requesting through our budget package, our goal will be to examine each new lender within 6 months of licensure and then on a regular minimum of 2-year cycle with also the ability to do follow-up and for-cause exams promptly. We have stepped up our enforcement as well. The legislature authorized 2 additional enforcement positions for us, specifically in addition to our mortgage lending enforcement staff in the February 08 session. And in 2008, we issued sanctions in 49 mortgage lending cases. Some of these cases, and you'll see, I think, attachment E in the package is a list of some of those cases. They included a variety of misconduct, including falsifying information on loan applications, misleading borrowers about the terms of their loans, Truth in Lending Act violations, misleading advertising, and failure to supervise loan originators. As the chair mentioned, in the fall of 2007, at the request of the governor, we formed a mortgage lending work group to work on many issues relating to lending practices. This followed a very lengthy and intense discussion of those issues during the 2007 legislative session. And I would like to take a moment to thank members of the work group, many of whom are in the audience today. The group included members of this legislative body, the chair, who was there for many, many long hours. Many industry representatives, consumer representatives. We've included a list of the work group participants in your packet. And the group, I think, did an excellent job, spent many hours sharing information, ideas, proposals, and looking for common ground. And the February 2008 legislation, which I've just mentioned, providing better information to those facing foreclosure, restricting mortgage rescue schemes, tightening up loan originator enforcement, all of those were the product of that work group. The group did continue to meet after the February session to talk about how Oregon should address a broad range of lending practices issues. We did not ask the group to reach consensus, and they did not reach consensus, as I'm sure you will be hearing later today, but the work group's input is nevertheless reflected in the mortgage lending bills that we are advancing for your consideration, House Bill 2188, which you will be hearing later today, and House Bill 2189, and I'm going to talk a little bit about some of the issues the work group discussed as well as what's in those bills as I go forward. At the time the work group was meeting, many of these same issues were also under consideration at the federal level, and the results were very positive. The Federal Reserve adopted strong new rules. Congress passed legislation, and more recently HUD has adopted new rules as well. Summaries of the federal requirements and the federal legislation are included in your packet. And among the new protections for borrowers are the following. First, enhanced disclosures for mortgages generally. A number of additional disclosures are required, but I'd like to draw your attention to two really key items in particular, and they are the new good faith estimate form and the new settlement statement, or HUD-1 form, and they are in your packet. And when a borrower engages in a loan transaction, Many would say that these are the most important documents that they review. The Truth in Lending Act disclosures are also of critical importance. And the good faith estimate is provided to a borrower within 3 days of their completing their loan application, and then again throughout the transaction if there are significant changes. And if you look at this good faith estimate, this is the type of information that a borrower should have in front of them. It tells them in clear, plain disclosures whether their interest rate and payments can increase, and if so, when and by how much, whether the loan has a negative amortization component, whether it has a balloon payment, what are the lender's charges, how do the charges interplay with interest rates, because often the fees or points you pay up front have an impact on your interest rate. And there's even a shopping chart that allows a borrower to compare various loans through this form. So we are very interested in this new GFE and the HUD one as well, which incidentally identifies, it's presented at or shortly before closing, and it identifies what has changed since the good faith estimate. The good faith estimate itself is now required to disclose what can and can't change so that, again, a borrower knows what to expect. Other new provisions from the federal side were additional restrictions on misleading advertising. Again, we have actually addressed many of those at the state level, but we certainly welcome the new federal rules. A prohibition on coercion of real estate appraisers to misrepresent value, a subject which has been of considerable concern. Restrictions on loan servicer abuses, and something which you'll also hear about later on, a national database to track loan originators as they move from state to state, and national loan originator licensing standards. The new federal standards also apply an additional set of restrictions to a category of loans which are defined in these rules as higher priced mortgages. And basically, it's a category that covers the subprime mortgage market. And so these additional protections for those loans include limits on prepayment penalties, which can lock a borrower into an unfavorable loan, a prohibition on making these loans without evaluating the borrower's ability to repay, and a requirement to verify income and assets on which the lender relies. So, in other words, stated income and no-doc types of loans would not be allowed. The federal standards are particularly helpful because they apply to all of the types of lenders that I mentioned earlier, whether state or federally regulated. So they create a level playing field and consistency across industry sectors. But in order to make those new federal standards effective, we believe it's very important that we have the ability to enforce those standards for state-regulated entities here at the state level. And I'm going to quote Mr. Tatman here as he says, we have the boots on the ground. And we're in lenders' offices, we do examinations, and we have the ability to do local enforcement. So one of our bills, House Bill 2189, will explicitly give DCBS the authority to enforce these federal standards here in Oregon for our lenders. That bill will also modify Oregon's law on loan originators to enable us to participate in that national licensing scheme, and it will apply consistent standards to all of the loan originators we license under that new system. And you will be hearing much more about that bill when it comes up for hearing, and there are a number of approaches and also probably a number of amendments. The federal standards, though, do leave some gaps. We believe that the Federal Reserve correctly identified the category of higher-priced mortgages as one posing particular risks to borrowers. And as I mentioned, there are additional protections for borrowers who take out those loans. But in addition to the category of higher-priced mortgages, we see very substantial risks to borrowers associated with any mortgages that have a negative amortization feature. And again, a negative amortization loan or an optional payment loan that has the potential for a negative amortization period is one where they're very complex loans and you do have the potential for having a principal balance increase. So due to the complexity of these loans and the potential for abuse, House Bill 2188 proposes the same restrictions for these loans as the federal rule applies to all higher-priced loans, limiting prepayment penalties, prohibiting those loans without evaluating the borrower's ability to repay, and requiring the verification of income and assets using the same standards as would apply under the federal rules. Next, we believe, as I mentioned, that the new good faith estimate form and additional disclosures in the Truth in Lending Act form will be very important for Oregonians to understand the complexities of the mortgage loans, which for many Oregonians are the biggest financial transaction they will ever undertake. But understanding that transaction, it can be challenging for anyone. It can be particularly challenging for someone who doesn't speak English as their primary language. And it's our belief that when a lender chooses to advertise or solicit loans in a language other than English, and where a significant part of the communication about that loan takes place in a language other than English, these basic disclosures should be made in that other language. And we proposed this in House Bill 2188, and the bill provides that DCBS would provide translated forms in the three languages other than English most commonly spoken in Oregon, which are Spanish, Russian, and Vietnamese. We also would propose that the borrower be given a notice in that other language stating that the closing documents will be in English, so that that borrower has the opportunity, if they desire, to bring someone with them to the closing who can help translate those documents. During the work group discussions, there was a great deal of attention paid to the value of some general standard of behavior for those engaged in mortgage lending, a general standard of conduct. And such a standard can take many forms. One approach taken in a number of states is to have a general obligation of good faith and fair dealing by statute. Oregon statutes don't currently use this precise wording, but we do actually have general standards that are quite strong. Under Oregon law, mortgage lenders and loan originators are prohibited from engaging in unfair or unethical practices or conduct in connection with the mortgage business, and they're also prohibited from omitting any material facts in a mortgage transaction. And under these standards, it's our view that a great number of the practices that have received additional discussion in the mortgage lending work group actually are already prohibited. For example, we believe that these standards already prohibit such actions as placing a borrower in a subprime loan without disclosing that the borrower qualifies for a prime loan, recommending particular loans or describing them as suitable without disclosing availability of other loans which might be more suitable or beneficial, recommending a refinance loan without accurately comparing it to the loan that it's replacing, failing to disclose key costs such as yield spread premiums at the same time that other key terms are discussed, or recommending one loan over another for the purpose of for the primary purpose of increasing the lender's compensation. So we've been asked by some of our stakeholders to address these areas in rulemaking, which we are in the process of doing. But again, we do want to make clear that Oregon law, as I've referred to, already exists. It prohibits unfair and unethical practices and conduct today, even in the absence of detailed rules. But our laws do create a problem for homeowners wishing to enforce these standards. Often a private right of action is the homeowner's best option, and Oregon law contains a private right of action for violations of these mortgage lending standards. Attorney fees may be awarded to a prevailing party under this section. We believe that in order to make this remedy meaningful and fair for homeowners, it's not appropriate to allow an award of attorney fees against that homeowner as long as the homeowner has not brought the action in bad faith or for purposes of harassment. And so our proposal, House Bill 2188, also incorporates a change to the attorney fee provision in our mortgage lending statutes. It would not allow attorney fees to be awarded against that plaintiff borrower if the action was not brought in bad faith or for the purpose of harassment, but with one important caveat. The plaintiff, prior to filing suit, would need to send the defendant a notice outlining the claim and the relief sought to give the defendant an opportunity to respond without litigation. This is similar to provisions currently in the Truth in Lending Act. So I know I've gone through a lot of material in a hurry, and when we get to the hearing on House Bill 2188, I hope to have the opportunity to come back very briefly to summarize again what's in that bill. But until then, Mr. Tapman and I would be happy to answer any questions.
Questions from the committee? Representative Wingard.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, this is very interesting to have in front of me because I drive to Lake Oswego tonight to sign papers on a refinance of my home. So.
And what do you think about the disclosures?
Very timely. Well, we'll see what's put in front of me tonight. But I want to make the point that I got into my home on an 80-20. So I qualify, I guess, under the definition of somebody who wouldn't have been able to afford a home without some of these mechanisms that you're mentioning here. So my line of question is, you know, I was looking at your percentages, and what I see is that it looks like 80 to 90% of the people who got these loans are still making payments on them. I mean, you were mentioning the default rate, but that by its very nature, there's a non-default rate implicit in those percentages. Do I have those figures wrong?
Mr. Chair, Representative Wingard, I wouldn't be able to give you a percentage of people who are succeeding in those loans because foreclosure is a point in time, and so we unfortunately don't have good enough data to be able to say of all of the loans of this type entered into over a particular period, what percentage are succeeding and what percentage are not. But it is certainly the case that many people with some of these variety of loan types, those loans have been successful for a number of people. And one of the reasons that these types of loans developed was that they allowed more people to become homeowners, no question.
Follow-up, Mr. Chair.
Follow-up?
Yeah, that was kind of the point that I wanted to make, which is that we had an explicit policy at the federal level, and I guess to some extent the state level, that we wanted to raise home ownership rates in this country. And so we've invited these kinds of loans, which the market provides, which are essentially riskier loans to people who would not normally have qualified, and they come with larger penalties, higher interest rates, all the things that you would expect a market to do in order to provide loans to folks like myself, for instance, 5 years ago, who couldn't have qualified under the basic rules where you expect a down payment of 10 or 20%. So my concern, obviously you're going to have a higher default rate just in general in that category. And then when you hit a recession, you're going to have an even higher default rate. But I did want to point out that there is a rather large, at this point, non-default rate, and that I would be concerned about anything that we do moving forward that limits people's ability to gain and move into that category of home ownership. And I'm certainly interested in isolating people who are acting in bad faith, but some of what is talked about in here eliminates whole categories of loans, and I just want to be on the record as saying that I'm concerned about anything where it still looks like, even some of these you're talking about, there are still a significant percentage of people who got loans under these conditions, and it enabled them to become a homeowner, and they are making the payments. So I just wanted to put that on the record. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And
go ahead.
Mr. Chair, if I could make one comment, Representative Wingard. The category of loans in House Bill 2188 that we are specifically addressing is negative amortization loans. Many of the restrictions on the other types of loans are at the federal level. And there was considerable discussion at the work group about whether we should simply ban negative amortization loans outright. And that isn't the approach that we're taking in this bill because we do believe that there are situations where those loans are appropriate. But we are proposing a higher level of scrutiny because of the risks associated with them. But it's a very legitimate point. One of our concerns is ensuring that we have a healthy mortgage lending industry here in Oregon that allows people to buy homes and finance those homes, but we also want those loans to be designed to be successful.
Representative Barton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for coming here today. Also, and our thanks to the work group for putting in this effort. So actually, my question, so assume for purposes of this question, is that I support what we're here trying to do here. It's not a big assumption. In 2188, for example, in Section 3, which is the section requiring documents to be in the same language in which the mortgage is negotiated, actually, I noticed, for example, it references a federal rule. I'm just wondering if that's actually not better done at a regulatory level than in statute. And I'm wondering, for example, by my read, ORS 59880 it seems to be a pretty broad enabling statute to give you the authority to actually regulate this right now. I'm wondering if A, you disagree, or B, you think there's a reason why this should be in statute instead of rule.
Mr. Chair, Representative Barton, I'm not sure. It's an interesting question, and as you can probably gather from my testimony, there are a number of areas where we've concluded that, that additional legislation probably isn't necessary. I am not clear that we would have the ability by rule, although we could certainly look at it, to require particular language, to particular disclosures in another language. Generally speaking, that's an area that our statutes don't address. We could look at it. I think feel more comfortable if you put it explicitly in statute. I think it would be something that the federal government should require. When we started looking at this issue, we actually started calling around to see whether we could get translations of the existing versions of the Good Faith Estimate form and the Truth in Lending Act form, because they are very standard forms that are used in every mortgage loan in this country. And we have a multicultural communications program because we provide a lot of our materials in multiple languages. And the head of that program started calling around to her opposite numbers in other states and the federal level. We could not find these forms translated anywhere. So I think the translation we can do anyway, but mandating that the translated forms be used, I think statutes would be helpful.
Thank you, Representative Barton. If I want to kind of hold off on specific questions about House Bill 2188 until after we open that public hearing, but if you have some more general questions, you're welcome to do a follow-up.
All the fair to you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Cowan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It will become very obvious very, very quickly that I'm not the legal mind in this group, so I will defer to others who do. But I'm hard-pressed as sort of that average, dated, traditional home loan sort of person to understand the value of a negative amortization loan or giving out a loan without some proof of ability to pay. That just doesn't make sense to me. And actually, I too am in the middle of doing a refinance and have been filling out this massive pile of documentation, which I thought was a really good idea as I worked my way through it, except that I had to do it over the weekend. That's okay. As I listen to all of this discussion, I never hear a distinction made between an individual's primary residence and a second or third home ownership. And I'm just curious if there's any attention paid to that along the way, and it's probably fueled by the fact that I live in an area where a good number of the real estate properties are second and third homes, and some of the homes that we see being foreclosed are those kinds of dwellings. Is there any distinction in any of the conversations made between those kinds of loans?
Mr. Chair and Representative Cowan, in fact, we define the definition of a mortgage loan. It addresses the question of what type of properties involved. And historically, we have picked up anything that was a one-to-four person residential dwelling, whether it was owner-occupied or not. And I'm sorry, Ms. Stradinger reminds me I should identify myself
for the record.
So as she introduced me, I'm David Tapman with the Division of Finance and Corporate Securities. And getting back to the question at hand, the Oregon definition historically has picked up all types of residential properties and would pick up those that would be used for second homes or even conceivably for income purposes, because we saw that a lot of people would do that, maybe to generate that income or take out a home equity line of credit off of a second home for purposes of individual consumer purposes. So it was very broad. The new federal law that Ms. Streisinger refers to is much more narrow, and it requires it to be owner-occupied. So I think one of the issues that will come up when we present this second bill of that we will not hear today is the question of, should it go as broad as Oregon law currently goes, or should it be narrowed down to what the federal government covers? It's our belief that it should be the broad version, and that's what we'll present, but that's certainly something for you and your colleagues to consider when we get to the point of addressing that bill.
Just one bit of follow-up. But if the term, so if I understand correctly, the term owner-occupied, that could still be a second dwelling. If you're not renting that second home out, it might be a beach home that you come to once out of the month. That would still be under the definition of owner-occupied. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair and Representative Cowan, I believe the concept was intended to be, the federal concept was intended to be just the one you use primarily as your dwelling. However, that is subject, as I say, to discussion at this level, because we'll be looking at it as a state definition, not a federal definition.
Okay. I'm just curious where it falls into this whole spectrum. Thank you.
I think we all are. Representative Widener.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Most of the defaults that are coming, do you guys have a good idea if they're people who went and extended their credit beyond their means to pay off credit cards, things like that, or are they just coming from bad home loans that they got into, subprime loans that they shouldn't have been in to begin with?
Mr. Chair, Representative Widener, I don't think we have that level of detail.
Okay. Because I think
you may be hearing more from other witnesses as you go forward on that.
I think that's something we need to look at pretty close to see if these are people that just got extended out, paid off their credit cards, and then went and ran their credit cards back up.
And Mr. Chair,
it might be a behavior problem that we're dealing with more so than a lending problem, because it sounds like we have everything covered pretty well. You're just wanting to tighten the rules up a little bit.
And Mr. Chair, Representative Widener, one of the issues in evaluating a borrower's ability to pay is should the borrower's entire debt obligations have to be looked at, and what should the ratios be? And again, you know, for those of us who are dating ourselves by being back to the era when you just had a 30-year fixed, there were ratios that lenders would apply, like your total debts can't exceed 33% of your income, for example. And so the traditional underwriting standards for loans, many of which haven't been applied in more recent years, did take into account other debt as well.
Other questions? All right, Ms. Streisinger, I think you got us off to a pretty good start here for conversation, and I appreciate that, and I'll probably bring you back up here shortly to testify on 2188. But at this point, I'd like to hear from some others that participated in the Mortgage Lending Work Group. And so, Linda Navarro, from the Oregon Bankers Association, and Pamela Levitt from the Credit Union Association.
Mr. Chair, I also have Paul Kirkbride with United Community Credit Union with me today. Sure. Chair Holvey, members of the committee, I'm Linda Navarro, President and CEO of the Oregon Bankers Association and the Independent Community Banks of Oregon. I appreciate the opportunity to be here today, and also I've appreciated the opportunity to participate in the Governor's Work Group on Mortgage Lending. I thought Ms. Streisinger did a great job today in her testimony and made many salient points. I will focus in on just a few things that I wanted to add to the discussion, and then I'd be happy to answer any questions. One of the points that she made, and I believe she made last week in some testimony before this committee, is about the different types of financial institutions and who's state regulated and who's not. And my membership, the membership of our association, includes every bank that is authorized to do banking business in Oregon, but 40 of those members are actually headquartered in this state, and I believe I may be one or two off. 38 are currently supervised by the state of Oregon in conjunction with federal regulators such as the FDIC. And it's those banks that are affected by the laws and rules that are specific to Oregon, in addition to all of the federal regulations that are put on our industry. On the note of federal regulations, in some handouts that I provided to you, there's a two-page handout that I thought you might find interesting that looks like a chart of regulations, because that's what it is. It's in 2008, it's the new regulations that our industry commented on that directly affect banking. And I provided this to you partly to show you the robust number of new regulations that face the banking industry as a whole each day. And we appreciate that these national regulations apply evenly across the country to banks of all sizes and charters. Charter is a choice, so those banks that have chosen to be regulated by the state have the choice of being regulated by the state, or they can pick a federal regulation. And I'm very pleased that the state bank charter has continued to be the charter of choice. We've had a few new banks organized recently that have opted for federal charters, but for the most part, the vast majority of our banks remain state chartered, those that are headquartered, again, in Oregon. Those that are not headquartered in Oregon are either state-chartered banks in Washington or other nearby states, or they have a national charter. So banks like, as you know, Bank of America, Chase, Wells Fargo, those are national banks that are not supervised by the state. I also want to clarify that when I say bank, I mean bank as in depository institutions that are highly regulated and have a fiduciary responsibility to their depositors and an obligation to safety and soundness. I point that out because we've found, particularly at the federal level in the current environment, the word bank is used pretty liberally and has encompassed many financial institutions that technically are not banks and are not depository institutions. Many of those are the very institutions that you've probably read and heard about quite a bit in terms of receiving federal funds during the last 6 months. I want to point out that most state charter banks actually do very little mortgage lending. Not all. Some are very engaged in mortgage lending, but the vast majority are focused, as Ms. Streisinger said, on commercial lending. And there's been some challenges in the current environment, as with any business exposed to the real estate market, with commercial real estate loans, loans to developers and builders that haven't been able to see through their obligations. That's put some stress on the state charter banks. But very few state charter banks actually have residential mortgage loans on their books, and those that do have a substantial number of those, they're by far mostly traditional mortgage loan products. We're actually hoping through all of this and through the lessons that we're learning on a national scale that community banks, those that are supervised by the state of Oregon, will become greater participants in the mortgage lending arena. We'd like to see a return of some of our member banks to the area of residential mortgage lending. If the environment holds up and allows them to thrive and be part of the solution to the current crisis, we think that will happen. I've had several banks indicate an interest, but by the same token, I'll be honest in saying that I'm deeply concerned about the ability of some of the smaller local banks in this country, and there's 8,500 across this country, banks in total, to be able to survive the regulatory burden that comes with being swept into solutions that are considered solutions to problems that were not caused by those banks. And what I'm trying to say is there is already a tremendous regulatory burden on small banks, and there's going to be more, much more, coming out of the federal government, and some of it's very good. But we remain concerned that there is an environment that is viable for state charter banks to continue to operate, because I do not agree with certain individuals that have said that, you know, a smaller number of nationally regulated banks is the solution. I believe there's a strong and viable place for the state chartered bank, and we're very hopeful that they will, as I said, become continue to be part of the solution and continuing to keep credit moving in our communities. So really what it boils down to from our point of view is balancing the need for safety and soundness and consumer protection with the ability for banks to be innovative and provide solutions that meet the credit needs of their communities. Just real quickly, I'm happy to answer questions on any of the federal matters. There's been more than I ever would have dreamed when we were here last February. You heard about some of the most important from Ms. Streisinger, and I'm sure you'll hear about other specific regulations and legislation from other folks that are testifying. I just want to point out that a couple things that we're focused on right now nationally in terms of the housing markets, we're focused on what we see as addressing a problem with negotiating foreclosures and mortgages that were securitized. And I believe Ms. Streisinger mentioned that. That is an issue that we're heavily involved in, and it's a federal issue. And secondly, we strongly believe that Congress needs to take action, use TARP funds that they've authorized specifically for the purpose of helping with foreclosure mitigation. And a lot of what's happening right now, and I know that some of the programs, I think Ms. Streisinger mentioned the Hope for Homeowners program, they haven't been as effective as we would like them to be, and we're working with the federal government on that. But there's a lot of voluntary programs like the Hope Now Alliance that have been working pretty well. Our numbers we've been given are that 2.2 million foreclosures have been avoided through the Hope Now Alliance, which includes many of the national lenders in Oregon, and it's a voluntary program, and almost 1 million have been actually mortgage modifications. They get about 7,000 calls a day nationally on that hotline, and again, it's a program developed and carried out by a voluntary group of lenders. The FDIC, I would like to point out, also has a concept out right now that we're working very closely with them to try to see if it could become a workable option for homeowners. And this is where we think some of the federal TARP funds could be used. It would provide, as I understand it, a partial guarantee against secondary defaults for mortgage modifications. So we think there's some real opportunity on a national basis for our industry to step forward and be part of it. So, again, I'll just close and say we want to be part of the solution. I think much of the work group's progress in the 07 and 08 sessions was very helpful, and I think, to be honest, I feel it didn't get enough attention, some of the meaningful reforms and bills that passed. But we're hopeful to keep credit flowing in Oregon, and with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. I think we'll listen to the credit unions first and then open it up to questions.
Perfect. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Pam Levitt. I represent the Credit Union Association of Oregon. We have 85 credit union members in Oregon. About 30 are state charter, which means the remaining are federally charter. However, of the state charters, we have about 75% of the assets in the state are held by the state charter credit unions. We were pleased to participate in the Mortgage Lending Work Group and really commend the work that has been done over the course of the last few years. I provided you with some written testimony. I'm not going to read it. I'm just going to highlight some items and then turn it over. I brought a mortgage expert, which you probably want to hear from more than you want to hear from me. Credit unions historically tend to make more conservative business decisions and investments, and we really were able to stay out of a lot of the mortgage problems that have gone on, although we're not immune to what's going on in the economy. Our members are losing their jobs, and we have a lot of car loans on the
the books and home equity lines of credits, and we're certainly feeling that. However, I do have some good news to report a little later in my testimony. I just want to reiterate that we are working hard to review and get information out to our credit unions on the new federal regulations. I provided you with some information on specifically the RESPA, the Real Estate Settlement Procedures Act, through HUD. However, truth in lending, these are all terms you're going to hear, but I just want to bring it down to what does that mean. It means that the federal government has come out with very new strict guidelines on mortgage lending, and certainly subprime mortgage lending. And our members, whether you're a large credit union or small credit union, state or federally chartered, if you're a federally insured financial institution, you have to comply with these new regulations. So we're working extremely hard to make sure we're in compliance. We're going to work with the state and support their efforts in their legislation here in the Capitol. But I think that a lot of the legislation that has been passed and the regulations that have been passed are very helpful to the consumer moving forward and getting new mortgage loans. I promised you a little bit of good news. I asked my members, what are you seeing in trends in mortgage lending? If you look on page 2, there's some exciting news to report in first mortgage applications. A few of my members have said there's such a high volume right now because of the lower interest rates that they're hiring temporary workers to come and just go over mortgage applications. Very low mortgage delinquency and very low foreclosure. I included some statistics for you. That's the good news. The bad news is, you know, we're not able to help everybody. We're helping those folks that come to us. Maybe they got a mortgage somewhere else and want to come and get a 30-year fix. We're, as Linda stated, we're doing what we can to refinance and go through and fix some of these loans. But there are problems out there, and certainly we're seeing that with our some of the defaults and delinquencies. But there is good news to report, and mortgage lending is happening. If you look at the very last page, first mortgage, real estate, and lines of credit, our volume numbers are up from September 2008 from the year before, and the most recent numbers we have are from September 2008. Credit unions, like all lenders in this country, certainly want to be part of the solution. We want to be at the table to help the discussion and are here to provide you with information and background that you need. I'd like to turn it over to Paul Kirkbride with Unitas Community Credit Union.
Thank you. My name is Paul Kirkbride. I'm the Vice President of Credit Services at Unitas Community Credit Union. I also oversee our home loan division, Unitas Mortgage. We currently have over $280 million in outstanding mortgage loans, and we service an additional $90 million on behalf of Fannie Mae. The vast majority of our loans were made in the state of Oregon to Oregon residents. 2008 was a challenging year for Oregon's economy. This was evident by the growing number of borrowers who were unable to make their monthly payment on or before the due date. And while our credit union is still experiencing low delinquency by most industry standards, we saw a clear uptick in past due mortgage payments during the fourth quarter, caused in most part by the growing number of underemployed and unemployed workers in our state. We expect to see a further increase in delinquent loans in 2009 as our members struggle to make their loan payments in these tough economic times. These delinquent payments are not the result of resetting adjustable rate mortgages or non-traditional mortgage programs such as option payment mortgages, which we did not offer. Some of our borrowers, including those with good credit, are simply unable to meet their financial obligations as they now face the loss of employment, hours, and layoffs. Being a mid-sized local financial institution affords us the ability to work one-on-one with each of our struggling borrowers. Before considering a foreclosure, we look at every available option, including a loan modification. In many cases, by modifying the terms of the loan, we are able to reduce a borrower's monthly mortgage payment, helping them to remain in their home, which is our number one goal. However, this solution assumes the borrower has the means to repay their debt under a modified arrangement, which is not necessarily the case during times of high unemployment when there is no longer a household income. In addition to helping our own borrowers, we also do what we can to help borrowers that come to us that have mortgages elsewhere. However, as home values decline and credit worsens, More and more Oregonians will be unable to refinance their mortgage and reduce their monthly payment. Without lower payments, many of these borrowers will be unable to meet their financial obligations. This will only worsen the problem we now face as a state by adding to the existing inventory of foreclosed homes and further depressing home values. This is a troubling cycle for both consumers and lenders. Thank you for your time today.
Thank you for your testimony, and maybe I'll start out with the questions. And Ms. Navarro, you kind of touched on one that also Corey Streisinger touched on a little bit, because it's encouraging to hear that there's loans being made out there, and you know, I guess we sort of assume that that's always the case. But certainly we also hear, and I've heard from some in the industry as well, is that they are having a lot of problems out there with renegotiating loan terms or renegotiating a loan someone's in to get out from underneath a potential foreclosure. And some of that is probably complicated by, you know, the loans being, you know, sold on the secondary market, and to a loan servicer who you don't necessarily identify as being the person you need to negotiate with. So I'm just kind of curious, you know, as we saw these TARP monies come in to help banks get out into the market and have money to loan, at the same time we're hearing that a lot of people can't be helped in this situation that normally you would think would be able to be helped. I'm just kind of curious, you know, what's the direction we need to go here as a state, you know, to ensure that people that are facing foreclosure have somebody to go talk to negotiate a new loan with? Because I've heard it from some institution people and some consumers that they're not getting somebody to talk to help them negotiate a loan that is resetting on them and they can't get out from underneath it.
Well, Chair Hovey, members of the committee, I think there are a few factors that make it difficult. One of those is certainly securitization, which you mentioned. Another is that we find, despite repeated attempts to contact a borrower, that about half of the borrowers will not speak to their lender until they reach foreclosure. So to address that issue, I think many of the initiatives that DCBS has led in terms of consumer education and assuring folks know about access numbers that lenders are required to provide to contact them is all an important step that the state can take. Another issue that's very troubling and is really a reflection of the economy and the housing market is that many borrowers would prefer to walk away from a loan that's totally underwater than refinance. And that is what the Hope for Homeownership problem, that federal program, that's one of the key problems with that program, because it has some, as I understand it, some sharing of equity that's recaptured in the home. And until they restructure that program, and they're working on that, that program is not always attractive to the borrower who's facing a situation where their home value declined beneath the mortgage that they have. And that could even be, that might not even be what you'd consider a toxic mortgage product. That could be a situation where they've lost their job and they have no equity in their home, and it's almost easier to walk away. I don't believe that's the case for everyone, certainly, and even most folks, but national reports show that that's a choice in some markets where values have really deteriorated. We're certainly reaching out to try to increase the ability of the troubled home buyer to access their lender, whoever it might be or whoever is servicing that loan. As I mentioned, one of our top two priorities this year is dealing with refinancing of securitized mortgages, and I think that's where that comes in. Most of these mortgages, when it comes to the banking industry, were made and held by national institutions, which is why the majority of our effort has been focused with Congress and the federal regulators. But I think providing education and information about those complex national programs here at the state level is one way that the state can provide value to struggling homeowners in Oregon. In terms of the TARP money, if I might add, I just want to clarify something. Half of the TARP money, or the original economic stabilization $700 billion quote-unquote bailout package that we've all read and heard about, has been dispersed. And half of that has been in the form of what I would consider bailout. A large majority of that has not been to banks. The other half that's been distributed has been distributed, as you mentioned, to healthy institutions that have been able to access that. But so far in Oregon, only two Oregon state charter banks have had access to TARP funds. A lot of other applications are pending. They're healthy banks that have pending applications, but they haven't been funded yet. So it's a relatively small number of institutions that are regulated by the state of Oregon that have had any access to federal TARP funds so far.
Share a comment at all?
Chair Harvey, members of the committee, as of today, I do not believe any credit union in the United States has taken advantage of TARP funds. In addition to that, credit unions that do mortgage loans traditionally portfolio those mortgage loans, which makes it much easier for us to work directly with the borrower. Even for loans that we sell into the secondary market, we traditionally service those as in addition to the ones that we have in our portfolio. It's in our best interest to work with the borrower whenever we can, because we do not obviously want to see that person be moved out of their house, and or we don't want to take the financial loss of having to take that home back in today's market. In terms of the securitization issue, I've dealt with many members who have first mortgage loans elsewhere who are coming across a significant challenge in just figuring out who to call. So it is a problem. However, from a credit union perspective, most of the time we're able to help people when they call us, and we do everything we can to reach out so they know that we are an option for them.
Thank you. Questions? Representative Widener.
This might be a little more in line with the banks, because credit unions don't really get involved with business loans. But have you noticed freeing up with business loans? Because I know right now we're facing unemployment, which is kind of creating the housing bubble, and I can understand why banks are and credit unions are kind of hesitant to even loan money right now, because unemployment keeps going up and up. But I would think it's something we need to look at, helping out the business community more than anything and getting more money to help them grow and develop. And I'm just wondering if there's any focus like that coming in from the federal level or anything at the state level, because funds had pretty much dried up there for any sort of loan for a business, even because people worried about them as well.
Well, Chair Holvey, Representative Widener. Our perspective is that lending has not dried up to the business community. However, credit standards have tightened, and what it comes down to is banks are in the business of making loans. They can't survive without making loans, and they're going to have to make loans to creditworthy borrowers because, as I said, they have the fiduciary responsibility to their depositors and to protect their institution. And we are a reflection of the economy in which we do business. And as businesses struggle to survive in this economy, it certainly affects their ability to obtain credit, and it affects our ability to extend credit, which is vital to our ability to be profitable and survive. We also, being highly regulated, and this kind of gets back to mortgage lending as well, it'd be nice to say that a bank would not foreclose on a loan and would be willing to, you know, ride out waves where their borrowers couldn't make payments. But from a regulatory standpoint, one thing that folks aren't always aware of is that there are very strict standards by which banks have to record and write down and move non-performing assets off their books. And that's part of their fiduciary responsibility to their shareholders and their borrowers. So there has been some struggles in the commercial real estate lending area in particular for a lot of our banks, but it's very few that have had to actually, I would say, you know, freeze credit for any period of time to shore up capital. Most are still lending. I'm not sure if that answers your question, but
it's more kind of looking how we can help industry to get people out and actively looking to grow a business or start a business. So, and it looks like Pam has an idea there. And because that's what I'm getting at, how can we help stimulate the economy and
Chair Holvey, Representative Widener, my idea is to allow credit unions to do more small business lending. We have, credit unions have been doing small business lending for years and years, which started with agriculture loans in the rural farming areas. Farmers needed those tractors, and we call them member business lending. But over the years, our members have developed and really determined that this is a great area, that credit unions can fill a niche that is needed for small business loans. We have a federal cap that is 12.25% of assets, and we're working diligently to relinquish that cap. Some of our members here in Oregon are getting close to that cap, and we would love to release that cap so that we can get some of those loans out the door. But it's an area that we believe that credit unions can fulfill, especially since we're local, we're in your communities, we know the small businesses, and it's an area that we'd like to do more in.
Thank you. Question? Representative Riley, you were
I've been trying to for quite a while, yes.
Okay. I was about ready to move on. But.
Yeah. Actually, my question has been partly answered, and it's a very simple, quick question for each of you. What percentage of your loans do you maintain in portfolio, and what percentage do you sell?
Representative Riley, Chair Holvey, I don't have the answer to that today, but I can certainly find out the answer or try to find out the answer to that. I think it's going to be different between a state chartered and a federally chartered bank.
Tell me the state chartered.
I'll find out for you.
Thank you.
Chair Holvey, Representative Riley, same answer. We'll have to find out with state charters. I think Paul has answers for his credit union individually, which he testified to.
Sure. Mr. Chair and Vice Chair Riley, on the document that I handed out, the single-page document, I believe we have the total portfolio there, $280 million. We hold in our portfolio, and $90 million of what we originated was sold to Fannie Mae. So at rough math, maybe 30%. That's probably not an exact figure, but it's close enough. We do retain servicing, though. So even though we did sell to the secondary market, that was because of liquidity and interest rate risk and credit risk. The rest, we members still communicate with us when they have a question about
the loan. Do you service all the loans even if you sell them?
We do.
Thank you.
We do.
Thank you. That would certainly be helpful. Everybody did that. But yeah. Representative Krieger.
Well, I can attest to the fact that they're being very careful who they loan to. I know I took an excavator to my house last Tuesday. It's not there. And credit unions did give me a loan, but I had to sign my signature about 60 times. Every form I could think of. I mean, there was a pile, and I swear to God, it was that thick. And I told them I'm going to start charging them $1 a signature. You know, but they are being careful. They are putting loans out. But I owed $6,000 to everything in the world. 310-acre ranch, $2 million with the timber on it. But they were still very, very careful at looking. And I can see that there are a lot of people probably just are not going to qualify under close scrutiny of today because of employment uncertainty and assets, that type of thing. But it was quite of an experience because, you know, I thought I had pretty good credit and I didn't owe anybody any money, had something that was worth a lot of money, but it still took some time to get it all worked through.
Yeah, I think the scrutiny has definitely changed in the last few years as a result of the situation of the subprime mortgage crisis, and the financial markets have certainly changed a lot. Further questions? Representative Gilliam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would say to Representative Krieger, I would pay a lot more than a dollar for your autograph, but under Senate Bill 10, and we're not here to discuss it. I wanted to ask, before we get into the specifics, we're going to move to a hearing on these bills, just your general feeling about regulation. It was alluded to in the testimony that you welcome, in our current crisis, you welcome regulation. But when you look at additional state and federal regulation coming down the pike, to what extent do you think it's going to help people that are hurting, people you all know, the unemployed, and is there a connection to it helping unemployment generally, in your view?
Go ahead. Chair Holvey, Representative Gilliam, I hope I didn't imply, you know, we welcome all this great new regulation. What I meant is on the mortgage lending side, so much has been passed at the federal level that impact both state and federally chartered. What I did say is I welcomed, you know, the review of the enforcement at the DCBS. That's not additional regulation. I can tell you that regulatory burden, I have my compliance officer here with me, who her full-time job is reviewing state federal regulation and helping educate our members. It impacts especially our smaller credit unions at a level that's extremely difficult. I can tell you for a fact that some of our smaller credit unions have merged into larger credit unions because they cannot keep up with the federal regulatory and state regulatory requirements. It's certainly a challenge. And so during the mortgage lending work group process, that was one of the things that I know that we looked at is what new laws and regulations were going to come down. We wanted to make sure we didn't have two separate, a state law and a federal law, trying to do the same thing. What came out was the new federal guidelines were strong enough, in my opinion, and that they would be enforced equally to both state and federal charters. So we do watch that, especially Paul's from a larger credit union. They have a department that can look at this, but if you're looking at a credit union with one or two or three staffers, it's extremely difficult.
Chair Holvey, just a quick addition. I would agree with Pam, but I'd also I'd like to reiterate that I think that the work that was done in 2007 and 2008 was an example of good additional regulation at the state level, because it wasn't duplicity of federal regulation. It was regulating practitioners and practices at the state level that were previously underregulated or unregulated. And I think that's where the state has focused and should continue to focus, is looking at what abuses might be taking place in areas that are underregulated or unregulated without creating duplicity for regulated sectors. Now, I'm specifically speaking about the bills that already passed that I think provided some greater reporting and licensing requirements around mortgage licensees, as well as practices such as the mortgage consulting and some of those maybe services that were outside of the regulated sector.
Thank you, and I appreciate you coming forward and giving us your testimony and the state of the state and the world of mortgage lending.
Thank you. Appreciate that.
I'm sure we'll have more opportunities. But I'm going to try to move this along. We've got several more people that want to talk, and we haven't even got to our public hearing yet on the bill, so hopefully we'll be out of here by 6. But right now I'd like to bring up Sybil Hebb and Bill Goldsmith. Welcome, and thank you for coming and being willing to testify. If you'd state your name for the record, that would be great. And committee members, these two individuals also participated in the mortgage lending work group.
I'm Phil Goldsmith, and as thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. As the chair stated, I
participated in the mortgage lending work group pretty actively. I'm a lawyer in private practice in Portland, and in my practice, I often represent borrowers in mortgage-related issues, not all of which result in litigation. I certainly support the concepts that are reflected in House Bill 2188, and some concepts that will be discussed by other consumer advocates to provide other substantive protections. But in my testimony, I want to focus on the essentially four ways in which the existing laws, particularly the Oregon mortgage lender law, can be enhanced in its ability, that is, its already existing provisions can be better enforced by aggrieved individuals. The Oregon mortgage lender law provides a firm foundation for regulation of practices. As Ms. Dreisinger talked about, it prohibits misrepresentations and the omissions of material facts. It allows for enforcement both by DCBS and by private individuals who have suffered loss. In my written testimony, I cite to various statutes and cases. I'm not, for the most part, will not refer to them in my oral testimony. But experiences showed four weaknesses in the effectiveness of this statute for individuals who've been harmed by unfair practices. One of them, as mortgage lenders and as mortgage brokers have fallen on economic hard times and gone out of business, it's become clear that the statutory surety bond is inadequate. Currently, the bond is between $25,000 and $50,000. Oftentimes, a single individual is damaged by more than that amount. When a business becomes insolvent, it's caused harm to a number of people. It's clear that $50,000 is not going to be enough money to take care of, to make those people whole, or even come close to making those people whole for the losses that they've suffered. Now, there's federal legislation that's now requires bonding to be based on volume of loans that are made, scalable. Sometimes the word that gets used, but that sounds sort of like jargon to me. And House Bill 2189 proposes implementing the federal standards, and I think this is appropriate, through regulation that's adopted by DCBS, because it provides for more flexibility than picking numbers which may be appropriate now and may not be appropriate later. But I think it's important that the committee send a strong signal to DCBS when it promulgates regulations that the minimum size of the bond should be substantially higher than it is now, because in many instances a single individual who's defrauded by somebody that's on the verge of failing economically can suffer losses of $100,000 or more. A second problem is largely addressed by Ms. Streisinger's testimony. I'm just going to emphasize a couple of points on that, and that's the existing attorney fee provision, because right now a private individual who brings a lawsuit, the prevailing party, whether it be the individual or the mortgage banker or mortgage broker who's sued, the court can award the attorney fees to that prevailing party. So that requires me, when I talk to clients who have good claims, legally and factually sound, I have to tell them, so nothing in life is guaranteed. There's always a chance that you'll not win, and there's a chance if you don't win that the judge will make you pay the defendant's attorney fees, and those could be tens of thousands of dollars. For somebody who's an ordinary person, that oftentimes causes them not to pursue their rights, even if they have valid claims, legally and factually strong claims. House Bill 2188 would remedy that problem. I would suggest that the committee make this portion of the bill effective for all lawsuits that are filed after the statutory amendments take effect, if they do, which is different than the bill currently says, which would only be for loans made after the effective date. A third problem is that maybe as a result of historical accident, Ms. Dreisinger talked about, there's different statutes that regulate different entities, and so not this good platform that's created by the Oregon Mortgage Lender Act is subject to a number of exemptions. So companies that may be familiar to you as home lenders, like American General, Household Beneficial, they're not regulated under Chapter 59, and that's because they got a license under the Oregon Consumer Finance Act in Chapter 725, and currently that those are exempt from the statute, even though a couple of things are important. One is there is no private right of action under Chapter 725. And the second thing is that those loans, the Consumer Finance Act, is designed for loans of $50,000 or less. We all know that there are very few home loans that meet those criteria, and most loans that are made by 725 lenders that are secured by a home are well above that amount. I understand that from discussions with DCBS, they may be supportive of removing that exemption. I'd also suggest that right now the statute exempts all lenders who are banks or other regulated financial institutions. And it seems to me that this statute ought to apply, if it's constitutionally permissible, to all who make mortgage loans. Currently, as you undoubtedly know, as a result of the past administration in Washington, states are preempted from regulating national banks, federal savings and loan associations, and other national lenders. And what my suggestion would be is that if the state's preempted, then the statute should exempt both the federal lenders that are so covered by preemption and the state analogs, so that, you know, if a state chartered bank doesn't feel like it has to become a national chartered bank because otherwise it's subject to an uneven playing field. But this would give Oregon the possibility, if there are changes in Washington over time, to expand the scope of how the statute applies. The final suggestion I have is that the statute potentially does not provide people who've been injured by a fraudulent or deceptive loan for their emotional distress. The statute awards damages for what's called ascertainable loss, and it's uncertain and it's undecided by courts whether that includes emotional injury, fear of that people and worry that people have when they feel like they're going to lose their home because they've gotten themselves tricked into a bad loan. Other consumer protection statutes, the Unlawful Debt Collection Protection Act, was construed years ago by the Oregon Court of Appeals as permitting recovery for both economic and emotional loss, and borrowers on home loans who are tricked or cheated should have the same kind of protection. In my written testimony, I suggest the small language change that would be necessary to achieve that end. So in conclusion, I thank you for the opportunity to testify before this committee and hopefully suggest changes that will strengthen the existing laws so that the bad years that we've experienced in the recent past won't recur in the future.
Thank you. Ms. Hebb?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Sybil Hebb for the Oregon Law Center, and thank you very much for the opportunity to testify before you today.
about these important issues. The Oregon Law Center is, as many of you know, a statewide nonprofit law firm. We represent the interests of low-income Oregonians, and our mission is to help them achieve access to justice. Because we're not able to serve all of the clients who qualify for our services, we try to prioritize those issues that we feel are the most essential to our clients, and we try to address the issues that are important to the most vulnerable of Oregonians. And so, as you might imagine, foreclosure and mortgage lending, as it relates to people's potential loss of their homes, is an incredibly important issue. It affects their stability economically as well as emotionally, and it affects the stability of families as well as of communities. And so it's something that we've taken a growing interest in because we're seeing a growing number of problems, not only related to homeowners who are facing the potential loss of their home, but also a new class of people who I think have been in some ways, in many ways, left out of these discussions, and that is tenants who are living in homes that they rent from landlords who are losing their homes to foreclosure. And we have seen a rising tide of questions coming to us from tenants who are at great risk of losing their homes, equal risk of losing their homes as our homeowners in this situation, but who have very little clarity in the law, very little understanding of what it is that are their rights and their obligations. And so it's an interesting area that we're hoping to take a greater look at, and I have some recommendations. I want to thank you all, and I want to thank the chair and the members of the committee, as well as the governor and DCBS, for focusing our attention on these issues. We do appreciate the new restrictions and regulations that have been put into place at the federal level, and very much appreciate the protections that will be added here in Oregon through both of the bills that will be coming forward from the Mortgage Lending Workgroup. But we do think that there are some significant gaps, and I wanted to just lightly touch on those, and then I'll talk just a little bit more about the tenants issue because I think it deserves sort of a broad spread view. And don't be scared by my testimony. It's overly long, and I won't go into as much detail as I have written down. But just to talk about the gaps that I believe are left by the efforts or the product of the Mortgage Work Group, Mortgage Lending Work Group, I am concerned that under the proposal, the enhanced level of protection and scrutiny that should be applied towards some of the higher risk, more complicated loans under the current proposals does not apply to all such loans. So the federal regulations apply some basic standards that should apply to the sort of general, to all mortgage lending. And then they imply some enhanced scrutiny that that should be given before undergoing a very complex, complicated loan, the type of which that is potentially susceptible to abuse and also which is really it just creates great buyer confusion. And we think that there are a number of loans that fall into that category and that the heightened scrutiny, that the theory behind heightened scrutiny for those complex loans is a good theory and that scrutiny ought to apply to all loans that fall into that category. And so that would include negative amortization loans as well as interest-only loans and any other new product that comes up that that applies the same sort of triggers. I want to talk briefly about the duty of good faith and fair dealing. It's something that we understand could be further addressed by rule because we do think that there are some standards. There is some general language in the statute that probably could be further interpreted to specifically require brokers and lenders to use good faith and fair dealing with respect to all of their customers. We believe that that's the common assumption. When a person goes to look for a loan, they trust the information and the advice of the person with whom they're negotiating. There's a great imbalance in power because the broker or the lender has so much information and so much more training and education about the issues than does the buyer, the borrower. And we believe that it's important to have very specific codification around what is the duty between those parties. And we think that further clarification should be provided at least by rule, if not by statute. Also want to talk briefly about the essential terms of a loan. Our current statutory structure does require a disclosure of material facts that are essential to the substance of the loan. We think that could use some clarification to make sure that buyers have an easily understandable, easily readable comparison sheet that will help them understand what is their monthly minimum payment, what are their requirements and their obligations, and help them compare and contrast offers that they're considering. We think that that protects against abuse, but it also just protects against confusion and potential bad decisions. So it helps on all sides. Appreciate the inclusion of a requirement that disclosures be provided in languages other than English when the broker is soliciting business in that language and undertakes the negotiations in that language. Some of our most vulnerable clients are non-English speaking families who are particularly, I think, susceptible to confusion and potential misrepresentation. So we appreciate that inclusion in the bill. Mr. Goldsmith spoke about enforcement, and I echo the comments that he made on that respect, so I won't go into them any further. I do want to just move now to speaking about tenants. We have a recent report from the National Low Income Housing Coalition, which identifies for us that 1 in 5 foreclosures is of a home that is inhabited by tenants. In Oregon, that's, according to the numbers, I think, that we heard from DCBS earlier this morning, or earlier this afternoon, that's approximately 2,000 families per quarter would be tenants if we apply that ratio. So it's a significant number. That's playing out in our offices across the state as we're seeing more clients and questions come in. Under current law, tenancies are essentially negated by a foreclosure proceeding. And so regardless of whether you have a year-long lease or a six-month lease or a month-to-month lease, your lease is wiped out by the foreclosure proceeding. And in the end, you lose that, you lose your rights as a tenant. And so that's a significant problem. We've had families who have incurred moving costs, switched their children's schools, made job commitments in reliance on a year-long lease, and to have that wiped out obviously causes many problems across the entire family. This is true whether you as a tenant have paid your monthly rent on time every month or not. So these are truly innocent parties who have had absolutely nothing to do with the terms of the loan or the experience of the loan, and they're being significantly negatively impacted. I think there are a number of recommendations that I hope that the committees on both sides of the legislature will begin considering. And it begins in sort of several different ways. One is, if a house is going into foreclosure, there are current rules that require lenders to provide notice, as you know, to the homeowner. In House Bill 3630 last session, we provided that notice, which provides significant amounts of information about where a homeowner can go for assistance, we provided that notice also be served on the occupant of the home if the lender has reason to know that the occupant is not the owner. And that was an effort, I think, to address this issue. We've learned, I think, that was not significant enough. It's not sufficient because oftentimes a tenant receives a notice. It's addressed to the homeowner. They may not open it. If they do open it, they receive information that is not geared towards them. As a tenant, they don't have the right to call the bank and begin negotiations. They can't get information. Many of the housing counselors who have been providing invaluable services haven't been aware of this issue and aren't informed about what tenants' rights are. So we need to look at that issue and make sure that we're giving tenants useful information so that they can avoid homelessness if possible. So there's the issue of notice to tenants in a foreclosure proceeding. There's also the issue of notice to tenants once the foreclosure is coming to an end. When an eviction needs to happen, how much notice should tenants get, and when should they be given that notice? Under current law, tenants can get notice up to 30 days prior to the date of the sale, the foreclosure sale. And so if you think about that, that means that the person giving the notice may not come from the landlord, it's coming from the lender or coming from the purchaser who doesn't own the home. And so a tenant is in a very confusing position. They get a notice, it's not from their landlord. They don't know whether they should obey the notice and start looking for a home, or should they pay their rent, which they owe under the obligations of their rental agreement. So they're in a catch-22, and there's not a lot of good advice to give them. Another thing that comes up as a result of that, so the solution to that, we would advocate, is that notices should not be sent until the ownership of the home is resolved. Is there a new owner? In which case, that owner then has the right to give a notice of termination. If there's not a new owner, then that right rests with the landlord. And so that's the clarity that we would seek on that particular piece. We'd also seek further clarity and protection for tenants in providing that leases are not extinguished. And so if you have a month-to-month lease, then once the ownership is resolved, you could be given a month's notice. If you have a year-long lease, then that that lease should run with the property, the way that it does if I sell a home to you, absent foreclosure. So that would be our the most protective measure for tenants. We also think that during the process of the foreclosure, there's a great lack of clarity over who's responsible for maintenance of the property, who's making repairs, who's accepting rent, who's owed the security deposit back to the tenant when the tenancy is over. So there's a great deal of clarity that can be provided there that would be very protective to tenants and their families. And I would just further summarize by saying that tenants, in many ways, are even more vulnerable than homeowners in this process. They're lower income. They have fewer other resources, and they are more likely to end up homeless as a result of foreclosure than our homeowners. So we appreciate the committee's attention to this new set of issues and look forward to having some further conversation. Thank you.
Thank you for that testimony, and thank you for all your participation in the mortgage lending work group and following these issues along. Don't know if we have specific questions for you at this point. Representative Widener, you want to stay late?
Fire away.
I'll just fire one. So I can understand, I mean, be sympathetic to the renters and, that are out there and everything, but you were mentioning some of the cases that you were getting, Mr. Goldsmith, where there's a lot of factual evidence and everything and wanting emotional distress for some of that. But you as an attorney have the right to take that case on pro bono, do you not? Or is current state law hindering you from doing that?
Representative Hovey, Chair Hovey, Representative Widener, I of course take certain cases on pro bono, but regardless of how I represent a client, the question is what damages the law permits that client to recover. And so if the law is ambiguous in that regard, and so regardless of how a person is represented, a court might conclude that they're not entitled to those damages.
Because one of the other things you get into,
follow-up,
would be maybe emotional stress for a lender to come back, and I mean that's what we could be opening Pandora's box there a little bit, is the way I see it. But I do think we need to look at making sure we're covering renters and some things that we need to do there. So probably look at the two most important issues that we run into with renters who are paying the rent on time and then the landlord's actually not making the payments like he needs to. So those are probably some issues that we need to sit down with the group and find out what's going on there. So,
thank you. Again, thank you for your testimony and coming up. And this is the beginning of a conversation I'm sure that we'll continue to have. Next up, I'd like to have Eric Wiley and Todd Williams. Are they still here? Waiting patiently?
Our meter's running dry, but we're still here.
They watch those things closely.
Chair Holby, members of the committee, thank you for having us be invited to testify. I too was a member, as was Todd, of the Mortgage Lending Work Group. I'm principal of Pacific Residential Mortgage based in Lake Oswego, Oregon, and vice chair of the Oregon Association of Mortgage Professionals Government Affairs Committee.
And your name is?
And my name is Eric Wiley.
Thanks,
Todd. In the interest of maybe talking about something new, I'd like to actually talk about what has already happened in the way of federal action. There has been a lot that has happened in the last 2 years. I think it's been an interesting time to experience the mortgage industry on our part, that is for sure. First off, I'd like to say I did not bring 25 copies of this. I could not have lifted it into this room. I'd like to start off with the fact that it's already been discussed that the state of Oregon has adopted the non-traditional subprime guidances that were issued by five federal agencies, and that began late 06 and into mid 07. Those have been implemented and have been implemented throughout the system, and by way of applying to all federally regulated institutions, they trickle down to state regulated institutions such as ourselves. I'd like to move on to the larger, much larger, H.R. 3221. It's the Housing and Economic Recovery Act of 2008. It also contains within its scope the SAFE Act, which is a required implementation of this body here in the state of Oregon this session. This act, is massive in its scope with respect to mortgage lending regulation and oversight. Within it are such things as the removal of down payment assistance funded by sellers through FHA lending programs, all the way to servicing and fiduciary responsibilities of a servicer, all the way to, again, licensing of state regulated mortgage loan officers, but then also loan originators at every level within the system, including at consumer finance companies, including at insurance companies, including at state credit unions, state banks, and then as well registration of all originators at federal institutions. This is very huge in scope. The requirements are, I'm just touching on obviously a summary, but the requirements are great in their detail. And within this is an interlocking, interwoven a variety of regulation that looks at the beginning of the transaction, all the way to the end of the transaction, and responsibilities therein. That's a large act, and that was followed up very quickly by RESPA's new rule. RESPA, Real Estate Settlement Procedures Act, was established in the mid-70s to cover disclosure of the costs associated with mortgage financing, and in conjunction with a couple years later, the Truth in Lending Act, the costs over time of that financing. This alone is massive in terms of its scope, its implementation, its change in how mortgage finance operates within the local community here, even in Oregon. And it applies to all mortgage lenders that offer mortgage financing. So first mortgages, second mortgages, all scope of mortgage financing. It was mentioned a little bit earlier today by the DCBS in terms of its purpose. Some of it was to disclose, some of its scope is to disclose relevant mortgage terms that were seen as potentially having been avoided in topic or in being addressed in the origination process of a loan and the subsequent closing of a loan, things that may have been quote-unquote glossed over. They are now front and center, and the scope of their front and centeredness is great in terms of the amount of times that they must be communicated to the consumer and how. One-page good faith estimate became four, and in addition to that, the closing costs have been largely either locked down, brought into a scope of a range, in other words, a 10% variance, or if it's a truly a third party that could not have had their fees estimated appropriately up front, changes can be allowed there. But as to the origination firm's ability to change the fees associated with the loan, those are locked down to a 0% tolerance, so a 0% variance. This becomes effective 1/1/2010. It's going to actually become effective throughout this year because all institutions have to adopt it and all of its implications sometime this year prior to 1/1/2010. This is a very large change, and I think addresses many pieces of discussion, of concern within the mortgage lending industry, of concern that people, consumers were taking loans they didn't understand, they had costs built in that they were not made aware of, etc. It also changes and modifies the closing process to closely mirror the upfront demonstration of the costs, and there's a one-to-one tie-in and mapping of those closing costs throughout. So that is, again, massive in change. Next, we have the Home Valuation Code of Conduct. That's an illegal agreement between the Attorney General of New York and Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. And this was before they were placed into conservatorship, but it carries through and is being adopted as of May of this year. And what its purpose is to make more distant and to make less able to be influenced the appraisal process in mortgage finance. This is one factor that has been addressed or has been identified as a concern area within objectively analyzing a home's value because the identification of undue influence by lenders as a whole, by individuals, maybe as small as a single person mortgage brokerage operating within a local community, as to the appraisal ordering influence. And so this changes how appraisals are ordered. This changes the ability, or actually removes the ability, of an appraiser to have any direct communication with an origination firm, that it would be an independent mortgage brokerage, or at a mortgage lender, a direct lender. The production staff can have no influence and no discussion and no ordering influence of the appraisal. This comes into effect May of this year. Then we've got an identity theft. It's a little different in scope, but it does address financial institutions, and all present that represent industries in this room must adopt a red flags rule that is also effective and rolls into place 5-1 of this year, which its purpose is to regulate and mandate upon those that offer credit and finance financial products to consumers. They must now take on the burden of identifying whether or not a consumer has been subjected to potential loss of identity or stolen identity or misuse of their credit. This comes into effect May of this year. We also have proposed rules to regulate and change the terms of the truth in lending rule. And this is being proposed by the Federal Reserve, and it's out for comment today. It would amend alter and actually improve upon the oversight of the Truth in Lending Act that was amended back in 1999. And this oversight actually would cause loans that have tolerance, generally, we could say, about 1.5% higher in APR above the going Freddie Mac offered rate, which is an average, let's just call it 5% today. If and when this comes into effect, we have 1.5% tolerance for high-cost lending. And so what that means is that any loan that would have an APR, annual percentage rate, above 6.5% in this example, would then be deemed to be high-cost. And all of the high-cost parameters that have been passed with respect to previous rulemaking and previous legislation would then apply to those loans as well. And, which is a significant reduction in scope from the prior 5% rule and, 8% rule, and is much wider in breadth in terms of having that hard and firm concept of just a 1.5% above the Freddie Mac offered rate threshold. So, in summary, I'd like to say that there has been a heck of a lot of regulation and oversight that has taken place as a result of the past 10 years loosening of credit standards. We've seen that obviously that has fallen front and center in the past 2 years. And the Feds, one of the big questions of the Mortgage Lending Work Group was, what would the Feds do? And they hadn't acted greatly if you roll back to just a year ago, heading into the short session. They have acted greatly since that time. And the oversight placed upon all of those that would offer mortgage products is great, and these are landmark changes. Many of them individually would be landmark changes, and these are landmark changes that come to all of us offering mortgage products within this next 12 months.
Thank you, Mr. Wiley. That was a pretty extensive and thorough explanation of what you're looking at as far as the changes. Appreciate that overview. I'm going to go on with the next up.
Chair Holvey, members of the committee, my name is Todd Williams. I am past president of the Oregon Association of Mortgage Professionals and chair of the Government Affairs Committee, and I am also a regulated licensee under ORS 59 as a mortgage brokerage and banking firm. And we have been since long before there was a statute, actually. I'm going to hit some highlights following on the pieces that Eric put together as kind of some summary. First of all, I want to make it very clear that we are in very strong support of most everything that the DCBS and DFCS have done. We've had a great working relationship with them for more than 15 years, and we thought the Mortgage Loan Work Group was the best way to handle very complex issues that had lots of consequences that were hard to determine through a legislative back and forth process that were much better handled in a work group, and we appreciated the opportunity to be involved in that, and I personally very much enjoyed working with Chair Holvey on that. One of the things that we've talked about in our association many, many, many times here is the importance to have equal treatment and equal regulation of the delivery channel of mortgage lending, so that a mortgage loan officer that works for a broker or a banker or a credit union or an insured institution is held to the same standards and has to provide the same information to a consumer regardless of the channel in which the loan is being delivered. That's one of the key reasons that for so long we have pushed for federal changes to address some of these monumental things. And I can tell you personally, I've been going to Washington, D.C. since 97 and testifying on this stuff. And I'm so happy that we made the moves that we did. Eric is right. We have thousands of pages of work, and we have every few weeks our lenders and our agencies, Fannie and Freddie and FHA, are coming up with new opinion letters and new clarifications of this stuff. So it is a very fluid process. Who'd have thought that creating new jobs in the regulatory and compliance world would be helping our economy at this point? But believe me, it's happening. We have an individual working for the state of Oregon that's doing nothing but implementing the SAFE Act, which is the and the National Mortgage Licensing System. I think it's important that we work from as close to a level playing field as we can, and moving things to the federal level so we're all held to the same standard was very important. I think another major premise that we've had here is the separation of the prime from the subprime market. The prime borrower is a much better educated borrower. It typically has an overall better financial situation, and most importantly, is not under a financial duress, is not suffering a financial hardship at the time they're securing that loan, so they're much more free to choose and shop and look around with their eyes wide open as a subprime borrower who already is either in or recently had a financial hardship and is more likely to take the first deal that comes along. The separation of those in this pile of stuff and the stuff that we've done here at the state, I think, is a very important thing. That's really all I'm going to talk about as far as the legislation is concerned, because Eric has hit it and so have several others. We are in support of what the DFCS and DCBS have done in general. You asked us to testify a little bit on the market, what we're seeing out there, and I wanted to hit some highlights for you on that. One of the good things that's happened is that while we have a lot of subprime arms and NAGAM arms and interest-only and intermediate-term arms that have and or are adjusting, one of the things that doesn't seem to make the headlines is when most of those loans were written, the rate indexes that drive those loans were in the fives. Today, the rate indexes that drive those loans are between 0.3, that's right, 0.3, almost zero, and about 2%. So those many of those borrowers, frankly, most all of those borrowers that are having rate resets from about 6-8 months ago until we see markets change, are actually seeing no increase in their interest rate or pretty dramatic decreases in their interest rates. Now, if you had a borrower that took out a negative amortization loan and they really thought that their 1% start rate payment was all they were ever going to have to do, I'm sorry, some of those people's expectations are coming home to roost. But a lot of those loans that had an effective interest rate of 7.5% 2 years ago have effective rates of 3.5%, 4%, 4.5% today. That's a very important piece that's not making it out that I think is important that our federal government has done by dropping interest rates dramatically. I think a couple of other pieces that are important are to remember that statistically, the data that we've been receiving and the data we provided to this body in previous meetings is that still today, the number one reason for foreclosure is an economic hardship, predominantly loss or reduction in income. That factor has nothing to do with somebody's mortgage loan. There is no doubt that there is a material part of the foreclosures that we're experiencing are due to layering, as we call it, of credit risks, putting little down payment and adding marginal credit or adding no income verification and just piling on these layers of risk that created some of our largest problems of bodies or blocks of loans. Those issues are gone. The guidance and the documents that Eric brought up has pretty much put an end to, and substantially rightly so, those practices, both in the prime and the subprime markets. A lot of us are hearing about, are we making loans, are we not making loans? If a loan is insured by, purchased by, or securitizable through the agencies, and I'm kind of combining them together now since Fannie and Freddie are now owned by the federal government as well, an FHA loan, a Fannie or Freddie underwritten loan, those loans are still being made and still being securitized, and at historically low rates. 5% kind of money is available. Three of you, I think, already made mentions of refinances that you're doing, and that is what is occurring. A couple of things that go with that that I think are important, since you ask about what's going on in the markets, is that, one, we still have really no jumbo loan market to speak of. In the Portland metropolitan area, where your new home prices are all in the $400,000 to $600,000 range and up, that market is still being severely impacted by the fact that there's no jumbo money available. If you're a builder and you've got 15 homes out there for sale at $500,000 or $600,000, unless somebody has $100,000 to $200,000 available for down payment, they substantially aren't getting loans, and that's affecting the market. Secondly, while interest rates are lower, the underwriting guidelines, as Representative Krieger mentioned in his commentary in one of his questions earlier, the underwriting guidelines are much more strict than they were. I would say at least 50% more strict than they were.
Across the board.
Across the board.
Yes.
Thirdly, we talked about yield spread premium and the use of yield spread premium to lower people's closing costs. Whether you're a supporter or a proponent of it, it's a fact. It does happen when properly used. Because banks are cash short right now and aren't willing to pay yield spread for higher premium, higher performing loans, yield spread pretty much doesn't exist in this market. So when we were doing loans with little or no loan fees or points before, most borrowers are having to pay $2,000 to $5,000 more in closing costs than they would have 2 years ago to get the same loan. Now again, they're getting great rates, but the concept of raising someone's rate by just an eighth or a quarter in rate to get them a loan at significantly less cost doesn't exist. You'd be raising that borrower's rate a full percent or more to try and create that. So it generally just doesn't exist in the marketplace. That means that it makes it hard for people to refinance because they need more cash or they need more equity. And it obviously means the same for purchasers. They need more cash to bring to the table. I wanted to make one specific note relative to Representative Cowan's comments, if I may, in your area of the market, and I can give you a specific example that's relative to the Home Valuation Code of Conduct or the new appraisal ordering statute that comes into effect. It basically takes the appraisal ordering process out of our hands. And when I say our hands, I mean pretty much the lending industry in general, regardless of the delivery channel, bank, credit union, etc. While the concept of that is great, the unintended consequences are you live in an area where there aren't as many transactions and there are a wide variety of homes, especially vacation homes and so forth. If we have to use an outside firm that orders the appraisal for us, and they order it from just a body of random appraisers, that appraiser may or may not have any competence of the market in the new greater Newport area or the waterfront market or the beach area market relative to your area. And without that expertise, the quality of reports that we get dramatically diminished, and a otherwise very qualified individual, good employment, good income, little debt, lots of assets, and so forth, may not be able to secure a loan because we've had to use an outside firm that's doing a random ordering of appraisals, and appraising a beachfront property in Newport, Oregon is a little different than appraising a standard single-family newer home in Clackamas, for instance, where there are hundreds of similar comparable properties. That's just one specific example of the mountain of changes that our industry has and will continue to experience for the next year or so to come. With that, I will conclude my testimony, and I hope that gave you an idea of the market in general that you were looking for.
Thank you. I appreciate both of your participation in the work group and giving us your perspective on what's happening today. I appreciate it. Representative Winger, a question?
Yes, Mr. Chair. First of all, Todd, can you beat the 4.8% that I'm getting on my refinance tonight?
That's the lowest rate at which I've locked a borrower, I can tell you that.
Mr. Chair, follow up. The real question. I want to delve into this. There are two ways to talk about this issue of bad loans being made. One is, of course, just from a consumer protection standpoint, but I'm trying to understand why the market tolerates an environment where you're making loans to people who are likely to default. And I guess I'm trying to figure out why anybody would want, if you're making loans and turning around and selling them to somebody, why would anybody want to buy those loans? In other words, why are they not holding you accountable for the fact that they only want to buy loans that are actually going to get paid on? Because I assume they do not want to deal with default. And I'm looking for some guidance from the two of you who work in the industry as to why you think some of this came about, I guess is my question.
Mr. Chair, Representative Wingard, I'll try to take that one. What we saw going back about 10 years ago, so 1998, was the automation of underwriting standards for Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. Those automated engines, as we called them, those engines set standards for saleable loans from a Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac standpoint. They essentially created a currency. Well, what happened was Wall Street looked at that currency and said, hey, you know, we have supply of money, and we'd like to get into that game. Homes are, at that point, not going down in value. They were, in fact, appreciating across this nation. And so Wall Street, with a supply of money, decided to come on in and compete against Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, who had represented with FHA and their four HUD a widespread, the vast majority of loans either securitized or funded at that time back prior to 1998 were Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, and FHA loans. Then you have Wall Street enter in, and they, by 2006, represented 60% of financed properties. And so their money made 60% of every dollar essentially financed into the housing marketplace in terms of current year fundings. that had an effect of pressuring down and pushing price down. So in other words, margin was removed from the system. Wall Street also approached it from the standpoint of not servicing those loans. And so they approached it from a standpoint of more passing on the risk. And hence, when we saw that model break, we saw banks in Japan, Germany, we saw nations falter, we saw cities falter, and progressively we've seen the credit markets falter. And so the question is, why would any rational company lend out its money and not expect to be paid back? And, you know, old-style banking, as was introduced earlier today, was that money came out of the vault and money was expected to, over time, be paid back into the vault. With securitization, which was a good thing for homeownership in this nation, Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac allowed liquidity back into the into the marketplace so that banks could replenish their vault after they had lent money. Wall Street did so aggressively, and over time, incrementally, created more risk in the marketplace by offering more and more creative products, or actually having an appetite for more and more creative products. And again, I think we've seen that they did so without regard to what would happen over time with the payments coming back into the vault. And so since that time, we've now seen Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac go into conservatorship after Wall Street had failed, or right around at the same time, and we're seeing the biggest banks in this nation also begin to show signs of weakening. So long story short, risk is put back into the system. Risk is identified as a high factor in determining whether or not a loan is a quality loan, and repayment is going to be made. You're seeing down payments increase in terms of requirement. You're seeing credit standards increase in terms of requirement, and you're seeing the stack of paperwork that you're probably having to have filled out with respect to applying for a mortgage greatly appreciate and increase in volume. So credit standards have greatly tightened, but to answer that question, lenders that weren't really lenders were involved in mortgage lending, and they're now gone, and frankly, they're not coming back in the form of their securitization ability.
Thank you.
Thank you. I knew that was going to be a long answer. Representative Riley.
Oh, just briefly. You say they're not coming back, and it, you know, that's probably true in some distance. I'm not sure how long, but we have a tendency to forget, and it happens over time. And I think that, you know, that idea that they're not coming back would be used to say, why bother to regulate things that are not happening now? I don't believe it. I mean, they will come back if we don't stop them from coming back.
Chair Holvey, Vice Chair Riley. That's a hard one to remember to do every time. I think the key piece is that securitization will continue and it will come back. But the difference is that some of the liability and responsibility for the practices that originated that loan to begin with, that sold that loan, that securitized that loan, and then ultimately serviced that loan, there will be a greater level of responsibility that moves its way back to the original point of origin. Eric's comments were spot on, but I think a simplistic answer to Representative Wingard's comment was, if an individual can deliver a product and sell a product and make a buck on it and have no responsibility for it as soon as that deal is done, kind of like the used car, once you drive it off the lot, it's yours concept, that occurred, it was occurring in our industry. The originator originated the loan. It was brokered. As long as somebody else underwrote it, they were like, my hands are clean, I get my money. Then it was packaged up into a big pool. They sold the big pool and said, well, you know, this all looks about like this. As long as you buy it, my hands are clean. And it went that way all the way to the end servicer. And then, of course, when it started to go the other way, they were like, well, sorry. And the dominoes started falling. We saw huge financial institutions cease to exist as a result of that practice. The difference between securitization, that we've had that flourished and ultimately collapsed, and the securitization that we expect to see, and I can almost guarantee you will go forward, is greater levels of scrutiny and responsibility from the very beginning all the way through the channel. And that deals with licensing of the individuals, banning from the industry, mm-hmm. greater net worth requirements, greater surety bonds, the licenses the insurance and requirements that Eric's firm and I have doubled and quadrupled just in the last 12 months. Those things are changing because of that. Does that answer your question, sir?
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Yes, it does. And in fact, I guess it sort of amplifies what I said. As long as we codify that responsibility, which we seem to be doing, then it won't reoccur. If we fail to codify that responsibility, it will reoccur. That's my mm-hmm. thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Wingard.
Very briefly, I just want to make the point again, because I think we're kind of circling around an issue of regulation or markets, but I think what I heard that you two gentlemen saying was that you believe, to some extent, the market itself now demands more accountability, because those end users are operating under the fool me once, shame on you, fool me twice, shame on me philosophy of, I mean, when you've watched catastrophic failures, people who run these institutions now are not about to be in a position where they're going to buy these kinds of securities and put their financial institutions at risk as they were in the past. I just that's what I thought I heard. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. And I appreciate both your gentlemen's participation, and I know this issue has been very close to you. I recognize the points that both Representative Riley and Representative Wingard have made, and certainly I think they both make good points. The market, I kept hearing a couple of years ago the market will correct itself, we don't need any regulation, and though the market has responded, it has taken federal regulation, as you know, that's coming down, having some sort of play in this, and certainly the foreclosures are largely due to because people lost their jobs. The economy has faltered greatly because of the lack of regulation in this specific industry. You can trace our economy back to some real collapses, as you've described, because people could not take any risk and make their commissions, make their money, and sell the risk down the road to some unknown entity in the future. But anyway, just had to close up that little comment between my two colleagues, and since I'm in the middle, I appreciate again both of you coming forward and staying late. I am going to carry over the public hearing on the bill for those of you that are sticking strictly for that. I have two more people that want to testify on my list, so I want to make sure they get an opportunity to talk. And again, I appreciate
Thank
your
you.
Comments.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And colleagues, I apologize for the lengthiness of this, but I think it was important to get everybody's comments on this and questions. And we will carry this bill over to Wednesday. Yeah, today's Monday. So next up is Angela Martin and Matt Wallace. Good afternoon.
Good evening, Chair Holvey, members of the committee. My name is Angela Martin. I'm here representing our Oregon. And I think we can now all appreciate the difficulty our friends at Department of Consumer and Business Services had keeping our mortgage lending work group meetings to a minimum. All of the participants have a lot to share, a lot of knowledge of the industry, both from an industry perspective and a consumer perspective. And I appreciate your giving us the opportunity to share a small part of what we learned during that process. I did have the opportunity to engage with the Mortgage Lending Work Group throughout the spring and summer of this year, and had the opportunity in that process to look at the breadth of federal regulations, state regulations that have been put in place to deal with the mortgage lending crisis. It is my firm conviction that based on everything that has been put in place and looking at what Oregon law currently has, there remain significant gaps that we have an opportunity to fill. And I'd like to take a few moments to provide an overview of the testimony where I go into where I think those gaps do indeed exist. I'll make the additional comment that states have always been the first on the scene when it came to protecting consumers in the mortgage market. They were the places where a lot of the regulations were first tried out, the testing grounds, and that's where many of the impetus for the federal regulations bubbled up from the states. So, again, I firmly believe that states have an appropriate and proper role in stepping into this mess. The first point I'd like to make is that we need to expand the scope of loans that are covered under the federal regulations. You heard Sybil Hebb discuss the fact that there are classes of loans that aren't covered by the federal regulations. Those class of loans, in addition to the payment option loans, which House Bill 2188 would cover, include other non-traditional loans such as interest-only loans. We have seen that the problem in the subprime market is not just a problem in the subprime market. It has gone to other products that federal regulations, again, have not touched on. It's particularly important for Oregon, where we were a leader in not only payment option loans, but in interest-only loans. And these are the types of loans that analysts are telling us to brace for the next wave of foreclosures. Many of these loans have a longer WIC than the subprime loans had and a higher reset. The payment shock for someone in an interest-only loan or a negative amortization loan is going to be larger than it is for someone in the subprime market. In addition to expanding the breadth and types of loans that are covered, we must consider the various types of loan originators that are covered by these protections. You heard many individuals today explain that Oregon law has different segments of our mortgage lending rules that cover different actors. In Oregon, this leaves the consumer at an unfair advantage. When they sit down at the table with their mortgage broker, your average borrower, even your above-average borrower, is not going to have the foresight to know, is this mortgage lender one that I get the full breadth of consumer protections from, or is this a mortgage lender that I get a certain small set of mortgage lending protections from? In particular, I'm referring to non-depository institutions that make mortgage loans in Oregon. We heard Ms. Streisinger explain that about two-thirds of Oregon mortgages are issued by non-depository institutions that are state-regulated. The full breadth of consumer protections should apply to all of those lenders so that consumer does not have to play a guessing game on what type of protections are offered by what lender. We continue to advocate for state policies that protect homeowner equity. We have seen that homeowner equity has not only been withered away by market values that are going down, but homeowner equity, which is often the largest source of wealth for our families, is dwindled through excessive fees that are levied on repeat finances. Homeowner equity is eroded through excessively high interest rates that are sold to homeowners that don't know that they would actually qualify for a 4.8 mortgage or a prime rate mortgage. Evidence has shown that a majority of borrowers who took out and were sold high-cost loans actually qualified for lower-cost prime rate loans. The policies that would put this protection into place fall under the category of good faith and fair dealing. We need to know that we clearly have the obligation, that every lender has the obligation to act honestly and fairly and in the borrower's best interest, and that obligation should start at the moment a borrower and lender start to negotiate the terms of a loan at the beginning of their meeting. We also advocate for curbing excessive fees and prepayment penalties. I'm going to take just a second to explain, first off, our support for House Bill 221 and the fact that it extends a two-year time limit on prepayment penalties to negative amortizing loans. This is a move that we support, but I want to emphasize that a limitation on a prepayment penalty, which is a fee that locks a homeowner into a particular loan, whether the loan is gaining in expense or whether it's about to readjust. Limitations come in two forms. You can either limit how long that prepayment penalty locks a borrower in. You can also limit how much that prepayment penalty costs. House Bill 228 simply addresses the duration. It does not address the cost. We would urge members of this committee to consider limiting also the cost of that excessive fees. Enforcement. The housing crisis has made us all too aware that enacting laws and rules does not guarantee compliance. While public enforcement is an important tool for addressing wide-scale abuses, public enforcement alone will not provide the remedy for losses suffered by an individual homeowner. Under the private right of action, we see that House Bill 2188 addresses access to private protection by ensuring borrowers are not liable for attorney fees on the opposing side when they bring a good faith case forward and happen to lose. This allows the homeowner to bring cases that are credible without taking on excessive risk. This remedy should also include not only the economic loss, but all non-economic losses that the homeowner incurred, and should apply, again, to all homeowners who took out a loan by a state-regulated lender. House Bill 2188 discusses how the attorney fees should apply to institutions regulated under Chapter 59. We would urge that all state-regulated lenders be covered by this. In my testimony, you'll see comments on the bonding. I think plenty of other people mentioned the issue of bonding, so I'll let that stand in my testimony and simply say ditto. Two other issues I want to comment on. First, the question of foreign language transactions. I think that was covered rather thoroughly in previous testimony, so I will echo my support for House Bill 2188 and the concept that when a loan is negotiated in a foreign language, key disclosures should also be presented in that language. When it comes to tenants, Representative Cowan, you made an important point when you asked about owner-occupied homes versus non-owner-occupied homes. I was rather shocked to learn that 40% of families facing eviction in foreclosure are actually renters. That is a serious problem for folks who are truly innocent bystanders to this process. In my testimony, I echo many of the recommendations that Sybil Hebb with the Oregon Law Center outlined. I stand by those and would urge you to consider those recommendations. I will end by, again, saying thank you for the opportunity to testify. This is an important issue. I think we've outlined some important areas where state lawmakers can come in and extend the protections to all Oregon homeowners. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay. So for the record, my name is Matt Wallace. I'm consumer advocate for the Oregon State Public Interest Research Group. OSPIRG is a statewide, citizens-based public interest advocacy organization. I'll try to, in the interest of not being duplicative in my oral testimony and in the interest of time, I'll keep my comments pretty brief. There are a few things that I wanted to highlight, both about the problem that we're in and about ways that we think there are opportunities for the state to move forward beyond federal regulations. And while we will, of course, have a public hearing, it sounds like on 2188 on Wednesday, I do want to take the opportunity to say to the, you know, the proposals represented therein definitely represent a significant step forward from OSPIRG's view, and we do anticipate a lot of places where we think the state has an opportunity to go further in truly protecting consumers and preventing the kind of crisis that we're in now from happening again down the line. As Representative Riley mentioned, too often, you know, memories are short, but to the problem that we're in, you know, it is as others have highlighted, and is just common sense at this point. You know, foreclosures are obviously on the rise nationally, and here in Oregon specifically. While we have been in many ways fortunate in the overall mortgage lending meltdown, you know, we've seen ourselves be sort of behind the curve in terms of when the wave of foreclosures crashes here that have previously crashed in places into you know, a potentially worse degree in places like Las Vegas or Southern California. But we are starting to see, you know, the rates of foreclosures catch up, as Ms. Streisinger mentioned. 14,000 loans that have been you know, basically delinquent or missed payment recently is a pretty high number for the state of Oregon. Last fall, we've seen, you know, houses in foreclosure and loans in foreclosure reach a 22-year high. And the other aspect of the problem that I just wanted to highlight on, because I think it is important, is that, you know, the foreclosure problem is very much tied up in the recession and the economic problem, of course, that we're facing right now. It's a fact that a recession will almost always lead to increased foreclosures. In this particular case, we've seen a situation where, you know, foreclosures have actually caused that recession, causing more foreclosures. And you know, it's a pretty vicious cycle in terms of both effects for homeowners and the effects for the economy at large. So aside from the larger economic fallout from the wave of foreclosures that we're in right now, having to do with the failing of the, you know, securitized loan products and the fallout from national and international financial institutions, there are a couple of key economic impacts that a wave of foreclosures has just by virtue of you know, of the foreclosures themselves. Obviously, the most significant, or perhaps not obvious, one of the most significant ones just has to do with the effect that foreclosures have on the values of homes and the livability in communities. So foreclosures in a neighborhood have a significant negative impact on the value of surrounding homes. Estimate put that at for every foreclosure within about a city block or an eighth of a mile, you can look at over $5,000 decrease just in the home value, and that's for each individual foreclosure. That's cumulative. Estimates that look at the sort of projected foreclosures that we can expect to see between 2008 and 2009 look at a total loss for Oregon of over $2.5 billion in reduced home value. That is a huge economic hit in and of itself. In addition to that, you know, as homeowners and families lose equity, as many have mentioned, you know, home equity is the most significant source of savings for many people and many families in Oregon. As that equity starts to decrease, you start to see, you know, additional hits to the economy in terms of just reduced consumer spending that look at, you know, when those savings take a pretty big hit. So, again, just, you know, we all know that we're in a mess. It's a pretty big problem, not to belabor the point, but those are just a couple of factors that I think that are important to remember, that while, that, you know, anything that addresses mortgage lending practices is designed, of course, to prevent the next crisis, and becomes all the more important in this context. So, quickly on the federal regulation, as many have pointed out, a lot has happened in the last year federally, and many of these protections represent big steps forward for Oregon consumers and you know, all consumers nationally. So again, the written testimony is focused on 2188, that if it's not distributed now, it can be distributed later. So I won't belabor every point, but I do want to hit a couple of areas where the state can go forward beyond what's happened federally and beyond what is, you know, currently proposed in House Bill 2188. The key area, I think, that has yet to be addressed, either at the federal level in terms of new rules and new regulations or in state proposals, is really addressing the incentives and duties that exist or should exist in the mortgage lending marketplace. As others have mentioned, when a consumer goes to shop for a mortgage loan, they have a very reasonable expectation that the loan originator or broker that they're working with have some obligation to actually act in their best interest. And while it may be true that some of those obligations do currently exist under Oregon law, we do think it absolutely needs to be clarified again, whether that's through rulemaking or statute, in terms of a duty of good faith or fair dealing, or even more specific obligations for brokers and originators to their clients. One specific key example of this, in terms of an incentive that exists in the mortgage marketplace, which often pits brokers and lenders against their borrowers and their clients and consumers, is the yield spread premium. And again, many people here in this room have discussed this issue quite a lot over the last couple of years. But for those that haven't, briefly, the yield spread premium is a payment from the lender to a mortgage broker that is compensation based on how much higher the interest rate for that loan is than what that borrower would just qualify for based on their credit risk. Now, it is true that in some situations the yield spread premium can act as a way to finance closing costs for the loan, or it's true that that can happen in theory. We've noticed the evidence suggests, and actually is pretty clear, that in practice that's simply not the case, and that yield spread premiums, more especially for subprime and other risky loans, more often act as an incentive for brokers to steer borrowers into loans that are just, quite simply put, a worse deal. So I want to highlight that specific point. Ultimately, we continue to advocate, for state policy forms, again, whether through statute or rulemaking, that will address some of these perverse market incentives and establish real duties, whether through clarifying an obligation for good faith and fair dealing or through more specific obligations that will continue to prey consumers and fill some of the regulatory gaps that exist between the significant steps that have been taken at the federal level, the steps further taken by House Bill 2188, and what we think we ultimately need to prevent this kind of thing from happening in the future. So thanks again for the opportunity to testify here today.
Thank you both for coming forward and providing the testimony today. Appreciate it. And I don't know if we have any questions. No questions. Thank you very much. Well, committee, it is getting late, and I know you are probably all ready to go, but I would like to ask David Tapman a question, if I could bring him back up, and I know everybody's really anxious to get out of here, as I am, but...
Mr. Chair, my pleasure to join you again. That's what you get for sticking around.
Yeah.
I'd have it no other way.
just real quick, there was a couple things that were brought up that I have a question about, and I don't know if you have an answer for me, but in regards to the loan servicers down the road, or people, securitizing the mortgages and selling them, and you end up not knowing who your lender is, or the loan originator didn't really have any risk involved. And so I've heard mentioned to it in testimony that that's being reversed in the federal, the new federal regulations. So, and I don't know if I heard that quite correctly, but I'm curious, is there something in regards to that you know of, or is there the ability of a requirement that those who make the loans, the original lenders, have a responsibility to service those loans? or have responsibility for the loans they make?
So Mr.
they can't,
Chair?
So they can't sell the responsibility down the road?
Mr. Chair, again, for the record, David Tapman with the Department of Consumer Business Services. While I was attending his testimony, I was also reviewing something called the Consumer Compliance Outlook, which was put out by the Federal Reserve Bank, who is responsible for most of these rules that you heard recently addressed through Truth in Lending Regulation Z. And I recall seeing something like that, and if you give me a moment, I'll see if I can find that. I don't believe there's anything that prohibits passing on that obligation so that one who originates a loan could sell that and could sell the servicing component also. What it addresses is more, that is the Reg Z component, addresses more practices and abuses around the way the servicing takes place. And so they put certain limitations. The three bullet points that are addressed are failing to credit a payment to an account as of the date received. So in other words, allowing something to go into default because they didn't put it on the books in time. Pyramiding of late fees. So in other words, allowing a number of late fees to pile onto each other and then cratering on top of each other and putting in a person in a position due to late fees plus penalties and alike. Not to be able to pay it off, and failing to provide an accurate loan payoff statement within a reasonable time of receiving a request for such a statement. That probably gets closest to what you're addressing, that is the inability for people to get information they need in a timely fashion. So between now and the time we come back to address House Bill 2188, I can get a little bit more information along that line. I don't believe that the Federal Reserve Bank's Regulation Z, Truth in Lending, is a panacea that addresses all the concerns about servicing. I think servicing is still an issue. Frankly, I think servicing is a problem just because of the sheer volume right now. We have more people than asking for information than they can get accommodated by the people involved. Frankly, banks are also looking to cut back in their obligations, and so they are laying people off. Rather than adding more people to address the servicing, they're trying to make do with a smaller staff because they also have lost their margin or the profits that they were receiving earlier in time. So I think you've got a situation where, as Mr. Wallace indicated, the one feeds upon itself, and then it feeds upon the first problem, and it becomes a vicious cycle. And as the banks are unable to collect on these things, they get into a position where they don't have the means to have adequate staff, and then therefore there isn't a sufficient number of people to answer the questions, and then more problems go into foreclosure. So it's circular, and I don't know where we put the line in to stop that circular problem. I'm not sure I've answered your question, but that identifies, I think, how far Reg Z went in addressing it.
Well, you came pretty close to answering it, so I'll look forward to seeing that as well, if I could get a copy of that from you.
I'll do that, or I'll just send you a outline as we understand it, and I can send it to you personally.
Yeah, that'd be great.
Since it won't really pertain to House Bill 2188.
Right. All right. Answers my question. I'll save the rest of them for public hearing.
Okay.
Thank you very much for you brave souls and patient people. Appreciate it. Like I said, we will carry over House Bill 2188, and with that, I adjourn the House Committee on Consumer Protection.